Boston Talent Radio.
Ed Griffin, do I have you on the line with me?
Well, I hope you do.
Am Ed, you're there, my brother. How are you?
I'm doing good. How are you doing?
I've got the creature from Jekyll Island on my desk. Oh, my God. They have no idea what we're going to cover tonight, Ed. Ed, what I'm going to do is cover a few quick announcements, and then I'm going to have the absolute privilege for the first time of ever having you on my Tuesday night More Heart Than Talent Mindset call. We're moving to the inspirational portion of the call, and I'm going to bring out one of the most exceptional human beings I've ever had the privilege of sharing the stage of life with on a few occasions. Ed is also going to be a keynote speaker at the Protégé Writer Speakers Workshop coming up in November. So, Ed, give me just a few minutes. I'll cover a few quick announcements, and then we are going to have a world-class call this evening. Folks, if you're on tonight's call, my name is Jeffrey Combs. I'm the president and founder of Golden Mastermind Seminars Incorporated. I've been hosting this call for 19 years. I've had some exceptional, inspirational speakers on this call, including the great Jim Rohn, Mark Victor Hansen, Dr. Judith Orloff, Susan Sly, numerous times, millionaire producers in the network marketing, direct sales industry, Alexis Romano, C.G. Siddons, Tara Romano, Don Ferrantino, and many, many, many other great, exceptional, inspirational, motivational, published authors, internet marketing rock stars, and a whole host of world-class people. And tonight, I have the privilege of bringing one of my most favorite speakers I've ever seen, and he really brings a unique product and brings a unique perspective and brings great content to tonight's call, Ed Griffin. Now, before I bring Ed out here, I'm going to let you know where I'm going to be speaking in the next few weeks, and then we'll move into the inspirational portion of tonight's call. This Saturday, I will be in Albany, New York with Frank Pecoraro. Frank is my host of the event. The third time Frank has hosted me in beautiful Albany, New York. It's going to be an absolute privilege and pleasure to take that ride to the Newark Airport via limousine up to upstate New York, one of the most beautiful drives in the state of New York. That is this Saturday, October 21st. October 28th, I'll be right there in that backyard again in Norwalk, Connecticut. November 11th, I'll be in near my backyard, beautiful Orange County, California. November 18th, one of my favorite cities of all time and one of the best restaurant cities in America, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. I will be in Atlanta, Georgia, December 2nd, Rye, New York, December 16th, and I'm going to be wrapping up the calendar year 2017 on December 30th in beautiful Marina Del Rey. Now, both Marina Del Rey and Orange County, California, my great friend and exceptional client, Marissa Campbell, will be hosting both of those events. January 6th, I'll be in Fort Lauderdale with Lisa Pazanza. And January 13th, I just put on the books Dallas, Texas. Later in February, I will be in Orlando, Florida. So those are a few of the places where you can see a More Heart Than Talent one-day inspirational event. Also, if you're on tonight's call and have not taken advantage of my free 15-minute coaching session, feel free to access that by contacting me on Facebook with your number and what you seek me to assist you with. I did 4 15-minute calls today, around 13 hours of coaching. So it's been a very productive day for me. And with that, I'm going to move into the inspirational portion of tonight's call. Now, it's with great pride and privilege that I'm able to bring our guest on tonight's call. G. Edward Griffin is an exceptional author, speaker, and philosopher that you definitely deserve to receive his content tonight. Now, I have known Ed for over 20-plus years. I was an associate in a number one income earner company that Ed was a keynote speaker in back in 1997. His insight and information absolutely captivated me and really led me onto a different level of understanding money, where money is created, the Central Reserve Bank, and many, many other topics that are controversial and enlightening in the same paragraph. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about Ed. I have actually two of his bios, but my favorite bio comes from his book, The Creature from Jekyll Island. So G. Edward Griffin is a writer and documentary film producer with many successful titles to his credit. Ed is listed in the Who's Who in America. He's also well known because of his unique talent for researching difficult topics and presenting them in clear terms that people can understand. Ed has dealt with such diversified subjects as archaeology, the ancient earth history, international banking, international subversion, terrorism, the history of taxation, U.S. foreign policy, the science and politics of cancer therapy, the Supreme Court, the United Nations. Some of his better-known previous works include The Discovery of Noah's Ark, Moles in High Places, The Open Gates of Troy, No Place to Hide, World Without Cancer, The Capitalistic Conspiracy, More Deadly Than War, The Grand Design, The Great Prison Break, and The Fearful Master. Ed is a graduate of Maize and Blue, the University of Michigan, where he majored in speech and communications. In preparation for writing The Creature from Jekyll Island, he also enrolled the College of Financial Planning located in Denver. He is an exceptional human being. He is a recipient of the Telly Award for Excellence in Television Production. He's a contributing editor for the New American Magazine and is just an exceptional human being. Ed also worked as a writer for Curtis LeMay, which I did not know this about Ed, who is a vice presidential running mate for George Wallace during the 1968 United States presidential campaign. Shortly thereafter, he began writing and producing documentary-style videos about the same controversial topics covered in his books such as Cancer, Historical Authenticity of Noah's Ark, the Federal Reserve, the Supreme Court, and many, many other topics. Ed, that is quite a bio.
Well, I'm exhausted just thinking about it.
Well, Ed, to say that you are a unique human being would be an understatement. Now, I note here that you are a graduate of the great University of Michigan. Go Maize and Blue, is that right?
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And you and I share this in common. You graduated a little before me. I also majored in speech communications. You also served in the armed forces, and I want to thank you for serving our great country. Now, in my hand is the book, The Creature from Jekyll Island, one of my favorite books. Before we get into that topic, can you tell us a little bit about what you've done in your many careers before you even got to the topic of The Creature from Jekyll Island?
Oh, wow. That's probably the most boring part of this whole story. But I'll be glad to answer the question, Jeff. It's I don't think I'm much different from most people. You go through life not really knowing what your path is. You start off in one direction. I thought when I went to school I was going to find a career in motion pictures and television. And in those days when I went through the university, they had a course on television. Well, that was just like that was really cutting edge because television in those days was black and white. There weren't many stations on the air. The television sets had screens about 6 inches and, you know, diagonal and all that sort of thing. So I thought, well, this is the upcoming technology. I'm going to become a great television producer or something like that. And well, to make a long story short, that when I finally got through the university and discovered that the world was not just waiting, standing in line to hire me and make me a great TV producer. In fact, I was very far from qualified from doing that. I'll just sort of wind this up. I finally had a wife and a child, and I'm running out of money, and I went to Hollywood, and that's a story in itself, but I won't bore you with that. I went to Hollywood. I had met Raymond Burr, who was sort of a personality, a celebrity. Perry Mason series, yeah. When I was in the service, I met him. He came through on a USO show, and I was putting on the shows, as a matter of fact, and so I got to meet him. And he said, well, when you come out to Hollywood, why, look me up, you know. He said, I can make some introductions for you. I said, oh, boy, I'm in. You know, here's a guy like this. So anyway, when I got out of the service, I went to Hollywood, called the number he gave me, and he answered the phone. I said, hey, Ray, this is Ed Griffin. He said, who?
Classic.
You know, classic, yeah.
Ed, many people don't know Raymond Burr, many people on the line wouldn't remember him, but I grew up watching Perry Mason with Della Street. This was only three channels back then. He was a major television star, like King Kong in the era.
He then went
on to star in Ironside. But also, he was the villain in the movie Rear Window with Jimmy Stewart, the great Alfred Hitchcock classic from the 50s.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he played a great part in that. So, well, anyway, we had lunch that day, and he said, well, I'll see what I can do. Well, that's the last I ever heard of him. So now moving forward, here I am in Hollywood now, and so I scrounged around trying to make contacts, and I ran out of money, and I noticed that there was a lot of talent there, Jeff. Talent there was far greater than mine, and these poor guys and gals, they were all waiting table and washing cars, you know, waiting for their big moment. And I said, I'm not going to do that.
Ed, I was one of those guys in the 80s waiting tables in Century City, waiting on Nancy Sinatra, so I remember, and
yeah.
Sean Penn.
Well, you know the scene very well. So I got a real job and went to work for a large insurance company. I started to climb the corporate ladder. I was doing pretty well, and I had my sights on getting to be at least a vice president. I checked out the company, said, oh, well, all these old guys at the top, they're getting ready to retire. I looked at the roster. There were not a lot of middle-aged fellows. They went from very old to very young. So I thought, well, when these old guys go up at the top, they're going to have to reach down and, you know, come down to my age and pull some of these fellows up. So that was my strategy, and it was going pretty well until I discovered what was really happening in the world. And, Jeff, I have to tell you, I guess I discovered then that I had a crusader gene. And it had never been activated before, at least not through school. And all of a sudden, I found myself very concerned about the future of our country, the future of my kids, my family. And, you know, I didn't realize I was that kind of a responsible person deep down underneath, because until then, I was just out to have a good time, you know, build a little materialistic world and, you know, get to be somebody and, you know, be a vice president and all that sort of thing, have a big retirement program. And all of a sudden, I said, that's not important. If we lose our liberty, our freedom, our country, our right to a fair trial, free speech, all these things, I saw them. This is the year 1959, 1960.
This is when Nixon's running for president against Kennedy. I mean, this is a very interesting time. This is the Cold War is going on. Ed, I grew up in this area. Now, there's something I want to point out here. So this is something that I also have taken on myself. This is important that people understand that you became cause-driven. You actually found a cause that inspired you more than money or success.
Well, that's true. Yeah, it was much bigger, much bigger. And, of course, I never had much doubt that I would be able to provide for my family at some level. But, you know, when I quit that really good job with the insurance company, which I did, I sent a letter to the president bawling him out for sponsoring a television series. The company sponsored a history television series where they got the history all screwed up, and they were messing with the traditional American concepts. And I said, you can't do that. That's wrong. It's historically inaccurate. And here I'm some little kid down there in the group insurance department. Anyway, that was my resignation letter. And all right, make a long story short. So then I started to put to work some of the skills I had learned in school, having to do with documentary films and writing and that sort of thing. So I started to produce some little very, very low-budget documentaries. And one thing led to another, and to finally I was doing higher-budget things, and people started asking me to come and speak on this topic and that topic, and one of the topics they wanted me to talk about was taxes. Well, I didn't know anything about taxes, but I did know something about inflation. So I remember this little old lady in Pasadena, actually, really, I mean, they laugh about little old ladies in Pasadena. This was one.
That was Jan and Dean, remember?
Yeah.
Not the Beach Boys, Jan and Dean.
Yeah. Yeah, that was it. And so this lady called me, and she had a study group in a beautiful home there, and she study group on taxes mostly. It was sort of a crusade against high taxes, and she wanted me to speak. She'd heard that I'm a free speaker, and she heard that it was a good job, so she wanted me to come and speak to her ladies, which was, I think there were about 30 or 40 of them. So I said, sure, I'll come and talk about taxation, which is a hidden form of, I mean, I'll talk about inflation, rather, which is a hidden form of taxation. So now that was a very interesting evening because I got a lot of positive response, and some people came up and said, you know, you ought to take that on the road. Well, you should never tell a budding public speaker that he had a good speech and he should put it on the road, because he will put it on the road.
Now, one other thing I want to interject, Ed. So you go from security, you go from a safe, secure insurance job, you're now a business owner, right? Because all my clients on this line are all entrepreneurs. They can feel you. They can feel what you're going through. Is that right? You are now in free enterprise.
That is right, in spades. Yeah, I just cut loose completely of the life raft and all of that, and I was out on my own.
You're how old at this time?
Well, let's see. I guess I was 26, 27, something like that.
Young and dangerous with the family, too.
Yeah. My poor wife, she almost had a heart attack. I mean, she thought I had lost my mind. And anyway, that's how it came about. And so I started to give a talk on money and inflation. Then people started to ask me at the ends of my lectures, you know, oh, what should I do with my investments? You know, my husband died, and I have a little inheritance, and I don't know whether I should get out of debt or should I buy real estate. And they're asking me practical questions as though I knew the answers. And I realized, I'm not kidding when I say this, I realized I was a fraud because I was offering myself as an expert on a topic. Well, I knew a lot about the Federal Reserve and the mechanism by which money comes into creation and all that. I knew about that fraud, too. But the people thought I really knew about money markets and practical things, which I did not. So that's when I quit that also. And as you said, I enrolled in the College of Financial Planning and got up to speed on the real world of money markets. And I never wanted to be a financial planner, but I just needed that education. So after I got through that, I decided to write the book, and there we go, 7 years.
Now, what year was that? Because the book comes out in 94, right?
Yeah, 94, yeah. So I think I probably started that around, I started it about 84 or 85. It was, it's hard to remember because, you know, I did a lot of other things along the way, Jeff, but if I took all the time just for that one book and put it end to end, I think it probably would have been a 3 or 4 year project.
Okay, I want to interject one other situation here that's fascinating to me. So in 68, there's, 68 election has three candidates, is that right?
Oh, I'm trying to remember now, my God.
Wallace.
Your memory is better than mine.
Wallace.
Wallace, yes.
Nixon,
I was involved
and Humphrey.
In that. Oh, yeah.
So there's so you actually worked for the Wallace campaign?
Well, yeah, in a way, yes. The word came down that they were looking for a speechwriter for Curtis LeMay.
Who's the running for vice president.
He was a vice presidential candidate with Wallace. Well, I didn't know anything about Curtis LeMay except he was a big famous general. He was in charge of the Air Force Dew Line, and he was the guy in charge of all of the atomic bomb flights. I mean, he was the top of the craft, you know. So they were looking for a speechwriter, and somebody said I could write speeches. Would I be interested? And I said, oh, sure. Who is this guy, Curtis LeMay? So I was invited over to his home in Beverly Hills and met him and his wife. They're wonderful people. I had no idea about his background and how unpopular he would eventually turn out to be with what we call today's left. So I wrote two or three good speeches for him, and he never delivered one of them. He was so he was very streetwise when it comes to military, but when it comes to the press, he was like putty in their hands because he'd stand up at a press conference and some newspaper reporter would say, "Well, General LeMay, why are you a racist and why are you running with this racist George Wallace? What do you have against black people?" And that was the end of it. I mean, his face would get red. Of course, that wasn't true. But and he never read my speeches.
Classic.
They just sucker him off into some, you know, defensive position, throwing all kinds of accusations on him. So I finally just quit and went home. And I said, I'm wasting my time.
What a fascinating start. Now, let's move right on. I wanted to lay the groundwork because I happen to know your background. I had the opportunity to see you speak at a financial convention in the 90s. That was my introduction to G. Edward Griffin. And so I met you in 1997, and I was a top income earner in a company where you spoke at an event. I was fascinated by the content. Now, I had already been studying the Federal Reserve. I'd been studying taxation. I'd been studying offshore banking. I mean, I was an amateur in conspiracy theories, and I was understanding the pharmaceutical industry. I mean, I was well in my way. You captivated me, and I purchased this book. I have my original copy right here, The Creature from Jekyll Island. Tell us a little bit of the history on. God, I could spend 5 hours on this interview because this is to say this topic is deep would be an understatement. And I have the privilege of having you speak for me on November 4th in Stockton, California, for a very, very select group of my top-tier clients called the Protégé Writer Speakers Workshop, like 30 people, Ed. So and they're going to really get the goods here. Yeah. What led you to the passion to write a book that took almost 10 years to take to publishing?
Well, as I said before, Jeff, it's something that just grew, and certainly I didn't start off with that mission. First of all, how do I say this? I really thought I was in over my head, and I quit.
You were.
I was, yeah. I had no background in banking, money, or anything like that. Here I am, a guy that studied speech and communications, you know, acting and giving speeches and all that stuff. What do I know about history or banking? Seriously.
But you're starting to dig into topics that are so deep and dark that...
I know. So anyway, I got into this because of the path I mentioned a moment ago. Just sort of wandered into it because people wanted to hear a speech on taxation, and that was, you know, the first domino. But then I finally came out the other end 10 years or so later, and I'd written this huge book. And in fact, I stopped twice in the process. I said, this is too much for me. There's too much here. I'll never finish this. Nobody's
608 pages,
this.
Ed. 608, yeah. Baby. This is not small print. This is not large print either. 608.
Yeah. I know. And as you probably recall, maybe you didn't notice, but there was no end to that story. I hadn't even come to World War II yet. I had just finished World War I, and here I am looking at this 600-page manuscript, and I'm thinking, if I do the rest of this story, it's going to be like a 3,000-page book. And then I said to myself, nobody will read it as it is, certainly not if I add any more to it. I'm going to stop here, and if people can't figure out what I'm talking about after all of this, another 300 pages isn't going to make any difference. So I just sort of stopped and said, okay, there's the story. You can figure it out. So anyway, having done that, I was afraid that somebody like a college professor would really nail me to the wall because there's just so much technical stuff and complicated history. And you can't take a long journey like that without stumbling along the path somewhere. So anyway, I was in fear and trembling that I was going to be exposed as a fraud.
Well, not only that, but you're dealing in a very, very interesting subject that you can be a target. I mean, this takes courage to write this kind of book. This is not the kind of book you're going to pick up in Barnes & Noble to go learn how to invest. This goes into the bloodlines that this goes deep into. I mean, this is so fascinating that it's intoxicating.
Yeah.
So
I was in fear that this was going to be exposed as a very inadequate and historically incorrect work.
I looked you up on Wikipedia. They called you an extreme right wing. Let's see. Conspiracy theorist.
Theorist, yeah, I know. Oh, therein lies another story, but we'll come back to that later.
Well, I'm good at interviewing you on this topic because I know what my audience is listening to. This really could be a 5-hour interview. I mean, because there's just so much here, but we're going to cover just some of the basics. All right. So, Jekyll Island is an island off the coast of Georgia, correct?
That's correct. Uh-huh.
Okay, so let's talk about what the Federal Reserve Bank is. Isn't this the fourth bank that the government comes up with?
Yeah, right. Well, first let's just clear up this Jekyll Island thing. Why is Jekyll Island a factor in a story of the Federal Reserve? And the answer is because one of the most interesting features about the Federal Reserve is that it was created under conditions of extreme secrecy, And this is not a conspiracy theory, by the way. This is well-documented fact by the people who participated in that secret meeting. And it was held on Jekyll Island off the coast of Georgia, as you just said. And in those days, this is 1910, in those days, Jekyll Island was privately owned by a small group of billionaires from New York, people like J.P. Morgan, William Rockefeller, and, you know, their business associates. And so it was a private club. It was an island. And they have a beautiful clubhouse there. It's still standing. And as a matter of fact, next weekend I'm going to be there. There's a conference going on there, and I'll be talking about the origins of the Federal Reserve right in the building where it happened, which is this clubhouse. And so anyway, the point is that back in 1910, there was a small group of six people, bankers. They're all the big, powerful bankers. They got together. They met clandestinely one evening in late November in at the New Jersey Railroad Station. They got on Senator Nelson Aldrich's private railroad car, and they traveled for two nights and a day, a 1,000-mile journey to the south to Brunswick, Georgia. They got off the train in the morning, took a ferry boat across the inland strait into Jekyll Island, and then they spent a whole week there around a table. And they hammered out what became the Federal Reserve Act. And when they were done, they came back the same way, only reversed the process. And for a long time after that, they denied vehemently that they ever attended such a meeting. What kind of a silly accusation would that be, you know? Of course, we didn't go to a meeting like that. And when I say there was secrecy about this meeting, I mean real secrecy.
Now, the reason this is important, Ed, for the people listening tonight and for American populace, number one, the American populace does not understand interest. They don't understand college loans. They buy homes they can't afford. They can afford the payment. They can't afford the home. And then they end up in liability debt. And then they pay interest on money that doesn't exist. And then they pay, most of America pays taxes and interest, then they have no money. Would you agree?
Absolutely, yeah. And they're both forms of taxation. Interest is a form of taxation. It's you have to pay it or you go to prison, and under most conditions. And as you said, most people don't understand it. But so anyway, that was all hammered together on Jekyll Island back in 1910. And it was, in essence, Jeff, as you well know, it was not, they were not creating a government agency, as most people think, even today, as I used to think. What they created was a cartel. It was no different than an oil cartel or a banana cartel. It just happens to be a banking cartel.
And what's the significance of that? If they come together to create a cartel, a money cartel, right around the turn of the century, how's this going to affect the American history?
Well, let me just slow down and make sure I get a handle on the answer. First of all, we have to understand what the essence of a cartel is. It's a shared monopoly. It's no different than a monopoly, except that there are different components. There are different competitors come together, and they say, we're not going to compete anymore. We'll all join together in a cartel, and between us, all of us together, we'll have a monopoly over this particular market. And so no point in us competing. We'll agree, you know, not to compete on prices, or we'll share processes and patents. We'll divide up the world in geography. You have North America, I get South America, and that kind of thing. And the whole object of any monopoly or cartel is to control the market so that the free market doesn't function, which means then they don't have to worry about competing and giving better services or lower prices. They can gouge the public. They can charge whatever they want to. They can provide whatever lousy service they care to, and the public has no place else to go. So that's what it was all about, and these guys took advantage of the fact that there was a lot of clamor from the public to have banking reform. The banks were stealing the people blind. And the people said, we want legislation to control these bad banks. And that's why this all thing happened. The bankers said, uh-oh, there's going to be some legislation to control us. And so they said, well, we're not going to sit around and let somebody draft this legislation. We'll do it. And that was the reason for the secrecy, because they actually drafted the Federal Reserve Act, which was supposed to control them. And so had the public known that the banks themselves had drafted their own controlling legislation, they would have been suspicious that maybe it wasn't to control the banks after all, which indeed it was not. So that was the reason for the secrecy, and the reason I thought it was important enough to put in the very first chapter of the book, because, you know, when people do things in secret, there's usually something to hide. So in discovering what it was that they were hiding, and discovering that it was a cartel that they were forming and not a government agency, and in discovering the fact that they had worked out in advance the fact that when the system fails, as that they knew it would, because it was not economically sound, that they could go to the taxpayers and get bailed out with tax money. If they understand those things, and all of that was evident up there in that meeting on Jekyll Island, if they understand those things, then they understand everything else that followed. And if you don't understand those things, then everything else is a mystery. It doesn't make sense. They say, well, the Federal Reserve they're making mistakes. Look, they did this wrong. They did this wrong. Well, they didn't solve the employment problem at all. They didn't solve inflation at all. Well, of course they didn't, because that's not their mission. The mission of any cartel is to advance the benefits of the cartel members, period. It had nothing to do with the world or the people or the country. It's a very selfish motive. And so once you understand that this is a cartel, it was done in secret, then you have no problem understanding that every once in a while the banks get bailed out with your money, and the rest of the money that's left over bails out the big corporations and the countries that owe money to the banks. And even if you bail out a corporation like General Motors, for example, where does most of that money go? It goes to the banks that loaned money to General Motors. So all of a sudden, then all of the mystery goes away, and you really, really come to understand what the banking system is all about in America.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
What does the term FICA money mean? It shows up in the book several times.
What money? FICA?
FICA money.
I guess I'm not connecting.
Well, let's go back to, there's another chapter that I really like. It's called Lead into Gold Alchemy. What does that mean?
Well, of course, it's a, sort of an analogy we talk about the alchemists of old were trying to convert lead into gold. And there's some historical evidence that maybe some of them did, but that's another issue. It's generally conceived that that was the Holy Grail. If anybody could convert lead into gold, why, they'd be the wealthiest people in the world. They can control the world. Well, in my book, I was talking about how the people who do create money out of nothing convert that into financing wars. And so the analogy of lead being a lead bullet. In other words, if you can finance wars and raise armies and determine the political fate of different nations because you're financing military machines, well, that's even better than, you know, gold. That is converting lead or turning war into gold. It's kind of an abstract thought, but it's very profound when you realize how the banking industry has been instrumental throughout the last couple of centuries in making wars very, very profitable for them.
The defense industry drives economy, one of the ways to drive an economy. And my audience tonight are primarily all part-time or full-time entrepreneurs. These are people who are in internet marketing, direct sales, network marketing, real estate investors, the mortgage industry, insurance. These are people who are creating prosperities in the comfort of their home. You've spoken to many of these audiences in the past. What insight would you give to someone who really doesn't understand money yet? They've traded time for money, they've had jobs, they've had traditional investments, they've lived a lot in debt. What insight would you give someone who's just really starting out on tonight's call?
Well, at the risk of sounding ridiculously oversimplified, I'll just say, learn about it. You better learn about it, because it's the medium of exchange. It's the lifeblood of your career. Money is your career doesn't develop unless you have an exchange of money. You need cash flow. You need something to create the wealth that justifies that. And it all gets transformed into money at some point. So if there's some hidden hand that has a grip totally on that element that you use in every business and commercial transaction of your life. If somebody has control over that element, they really are in a unique position to rip you off royally, and you may not even know it. That, in fact, is what is happening in the world today. So I don't see how it's really possible to do well economically in business if you don't understand money and if you don't understand the mechanisms by which the banks and all of their satellite operations are really like spiders in a web waiting for you to just come into the web, you know. "Come into my parlor," said the spider to the fly. They just love to get people into debt. They'll give you 107 different excuses that, or reasons why they think, or you should think, that that's really a good thing, get into debt and make money out of debt. Now, sometimes that's possible, but you have to be very, very careful, and so forth. Anyway, back to your question, I think the simple answer is you must understand the nature of money if you're going to be successful. Unless, of course, there are times in business cycles when the business and the economy is expanding, it's a lot easier to be successful for a short period of time because everything is expanding and you just sort of get caught up in the current. And if you're in the if you're lucky and if you're in the right place at the right time, you can make a lot of money, let's say in real estate, for example, because the bubble is going up. And you think, oh, my gosh, I'm a genius. Well, not necessarily, because if you are a genius, if you understand it's a bubble and you're poised so that when the bubble bursts, you don't get wiped out. Now you're a genius. You know, so but you have to understand the nature of money in order to do that. So that was my my short answer is you have to learn about the nature and function of money.
Let's talk about the seduction that goes on in today's world with the lending institutions, the educational platforms, the banks, the government, etc., and the little guy, the consumer. Most of America, they have a job that they trade time for money, and their job typically just consumes all their money, and then they start going into debt. Talk a little bit about the whole debt syndrome, debt cycle, and why so much of America just gets chewed up in it.
Well, I think the question contains the answer, Jeff. Yeah, so much of the output of America gets chewed up and consumed by interest on debt, interest on money that literally is created out of nothing, and
that's a key concept. It's created out of nothing. We'll revisit that in a second.
Yeah. So, everywhere you look in the world today, there's an implied message that debt is healthy. I have to laugh when I think of, I guess it was 2008, when all the banks were going bankrupt and going to the Congress and saying, "Hey, you've got to bail us out. Remember, we're your partners, so give us some tax money. We need $1 billion here and $3 billion there." And the banks were really had demonstrated themselves to be the most untrustworthy investment advisor you could ever find. And yet, it was the Bank of America, as I recall, that started a big television campaign about to use debt wisely, I think is how they did it. They were going to give courses to people on how to use debt wisely from the Bank of America, which had never handled debt wisely in its entire existence.
And here's a classic when I encounter my clients whose financial planners tell them not to pay their mortgages off because it's a tax write-off.
Uh-huh.
I mean,
well,
it's so
Yeah. Well, you know, that reminds me of like Seagram's whiskey saying, "Drink responsibly," in their commercials.
I know, it's classic, isn't it?
It's classic. Well, I use that. It's funny, but in a way, that is what we see all around us. You know, people say, "Well, check and see what your credit rating is," as though it's some kind of a sacred thing. You've got to know what your credit rating is, like it's valuable, you know. Your credit rating has to be good. Well, why does your credit rating have to be good? So you can borrow money, you know. And kids get this in school. They're worried about the credit rating even before they're old enough to borrow money, but they just can hardly wait. It's like a rite of passage. You get to be a certain age, you can go and buy beer and take out a loan. And I think maybe I'm making too light out of this, but everywhere you look, Jeff, as you know, the message is coming that debt is healthy, debt is good, debt is the path to happiness and prosperity. And there are, of course, there are legitimate and very healthy uses for debt, but certainly not consumer debt. And so we just have to be careful. I would advise anybody in your circle that's coming in for the first time to really take a hard look at the subliminal messaging that goes on in the commercial world. Debt, consumer debt, is not a good thing.
It isn't. And you see so many people that have mortgage debt, they have school loan debt, they have credit card debt. I mean, their whole paycheck goes to interest. Can you talk a little bit about how money gets created out of nothing and what that really means in to someone who's starting to understand the inner game of money?
Yeah, and this is, I think, the critical thing. I call it in my book the Mandrake Mechanism. After that, a comic book character back in the 1940s, I used to read this comic book. It was Mandrake the Magician, and he was quite a magician. He could wave his cape, and things would just materialize out of his cape, out of thin air. He'd wave his cape again, and they'd be gone. And it was quite a show he put on all the time. And I thought, well, this is what they do at the Federal Reserve. They wave their cape, and all of a sudden there's $1 billion that wasn't there before. And then they wave it again, and it's gone. We don't know where it went. It's magic. And most people are content to think that it's magic. They think that's a great magic show. They don't realize that it's costing them dearly because they're paying interest on that magic. How does the money come into being? Well, it's kind of an involved process. Let me see if I can shorten it down. There are two stages. This is important to understand. Two stages. It starts with the government. The government spends more money than it takes in taxes. Everybody knows that. So how does the government get more money than it takes it in taxes? Well, like anybody else, it borrows it. If you want to spend more money than you earn, you can borrow it if somebody's willing to lend it to you, if they think you're trustworthy and you're going to pay it back. So the government says, okay, we want to borrow some money, and people lend it money in the form of bonds. They buy bonds or treasury bills or notes or certificates of some kind, and they offer to pay interest on it. So, okay, now the government has more money than it takes in taxes. But lo and behold, at the end of the 30 days, 90 days, 1 year, 5 year, 10 year expiration date, now they have to pay it back plus interest. Well, when that day comes along, of course, they don't have it because they're still spending more money than they take in taxes. So they don't have the money to pay back the note, the promissory note. So no problem. They just go borrow some more. This time they borrow enough to pay off the original loan plus the interest that they owe and plus a huge amount more for new projects that have come along and are politically attractive to these guys. And everybody knows this process goes on and on and on and on. And until finally, this is called the national debt. It keeps growing, growing, and growing. And so the way that works is that, you know, let's just imagine that the Treasury Secretary walks into the Federal Reserve Bank someday. This is figurative now. And the Federal Reserve Bank president says, Mr. Secretary, come in. We've been expecting you. You're a little bit late today. How much money do you want today? And so the government official says, well, another $1 billion. No, make that $2 billion today. Thank you. So the Federal Reserve officer opens up the desk drawer. Again, remember, this is figurative. It's all done in computers. But imagine he pulls out a big black checkbook, and he writes a check for $2 billion to the United States Treasury, signs it, and gives it to the Treasury official. He says, thank you very much. Out the door he goes, and he deposits that money into the bank as he's going back to the White House or wherever he goes. And so now the government has $2 billion from that check from the Federal Reserve. Okay. Where did the Fed get that money? The answer is it didn't get it from any place. It doesn't have the money. It just wrote the check. It was a bad check. There was no money ever deposited into any account for that. And they just created that money by writing a check. Now, if you and I were to do that, of course, we'd go direct to the jail. We wouldn't even think about going past go. You know, directly to jail. But they can do it because Congress signed the Federal Reserve Act, which authorized that counterfeiting process. Now it's legal for the banks to do that, to create money out of nothing and put it into loan. So that's how money comes into being in the first stage. Now, that's just the beginning of the cycle. Let's suppose now that, let's follow, $1,000 of that $2 billion. The government takes it, and let's say they write a check to the fellow that or the gal that delivers our mail. And she got this $1,000 check now. It's a paycheck. She didn't know, doesn't care, that that money didn't exist yesterday. It's spendable, so she doesn't care. It's a government check. But she takes it to her bank now, her private bank down the street, and deposits it into her checking account. Now she has $1,000 of that newly made money. And now somebody comes into the bank and they say, look, I want to borrow $9,000, and do you have the money? And the banker says, sure. We just got $1,000 deposit here from this lady that delivers the mail. Sure, with this $1,000, we can loan you $9,000 for your car. And we might say, well, wait a minute. You got $1,000. How can you loan me $9,000? And the banker would have to say, at least in his mind, he'd say, this, never mind. Don't worry about it. It's all legal. It's quite okay. And in fact, the way the Federal Reserve Bill Act is written, the local bank can loan up to 9 times more than they actually have in deposit. And there again, it's another step where they create more money again on top of the money they already had created when they sent it to the government. So for every $1 billion that's created out of nothing for the federal government, then when that gets into circulation, the local commercial banks can create up to $9 billion more dollars out of nothing and push it into loans for individuals like you and me and corporations, other governments, institutions, and so forth.
So this also explains why people can go bankrupt more than one or two times.
Well, yes, there's no limit. I mean, the bankruptcy means nothing. If you can create money out of nothing, what does bankruptcy mean? You see, it's nothing. You just go make some more money. And I'm oversimplifying this. I know if a college professor were to call in and say, that's great oversimplification, I would acknowledge that. But in essence and in principle, that is really what happens. And so that's how money comes into existence. And don't forget, all of this money is earning interest. Now,
the money that doesn't exist is earning interest.
Well, it exists now because they created it, but it came out of thin air. It's backed by nothing. Well, that's an oversimplification, too. It's even worse than that. It's backed by debt. It's not backed by,
Can you explain that? Because it used to be backed by gold before the Federal Reserve, gold standard and the silver standard. I still have, lawful legal pieces of $20 Godin's beautiful pieces of coinage.
Yes.
I also have paper bills that say payable to bearer on demand in gold coin back in the day.
Yeah, that's the way it was. That's the way it should be. Those were the days when America was expanding and prospering and growing and becoming the most powerful nation in the world, is when money was backed by something tangible. In almost all cases, it's silver and gold or gold. But the thing to understand there for someone coming into this topic for the first time is the why should money be backed by something tangible? And the answer is really pretty simple, because money should expand at approximately the same rate as the expansion of goods and services throughout society. If the two expand at the same rate, then the purchasing power of the money remains constant. But if the money expands faster than the expansion of goods and services, then the value of the purchasing power of that monetary unit goes down, and that's what we call inflation. And the only way you can keep the supply of money at a constant ratio to the quantity of goods and services is to base the money on something which itself requires human effort to produce. If you can produce money out of nothing just by waving your mandrake wand or waving your cape, well, then, of course, the money supply is going to explode, which it always does under the system. But if the only way you can create money is to dig it out of the ground and refine it and put it into a nice shiny coin or into a bullion bar and attest to its purity and its weight and so forth, that means that the amount of money will expand only to the degree that humans are willing to go into the mine and dig it out and sweat and work and invest and build factories to refine it and so forth. It takes a lot of human effort to do that. The same thing on the other side, goods and services to make shoes and suits and build houses, that takes human effort too. And so the two sides of the ledger balance. And so the money supply expands at the same rate as goods and services. But, and there you have, the reason for that is to have a stable purchasing power of the money system. You've got to have the money backed by something that takes human effort to produce. So that's why banks hate, they love gold, by the way. Banks love gold and silver. That's why they have as much of it as they can possibly get in their vaults, because they understand that it holds purchasing power. But they just fight tooth and nail to have gold or silver as a backing for money. Because you see, if gold and silver is a backing for money, that means that the quantity of money is limited.
Yes, that's correct. That's the key component. Scarcity creates value.
Yeah, and not only that, but how does a bank make money? Charging interest on the loaning of money. So if the bank has a limited supply of money to loan, because it's backed by gold and silver, they can't just expand it. If they have a limited inventory, that means their profits are limited. So they hate a limited inventory of money. That's why they want to take the lid off and say we'll create money as much as we want because we collect interest on every one of those dollars.
And many of my clients don't even understand how in debt they are. So, I mean, here's a classic example. In today's world, it's not uncommon for a young man or a young woman to graduate from a state university, say in any Montclair State University in New Jersey or Michigan State University in Michigan. And in today's market, some of these colleges are $40,000. Boston University is $70,000 a year. I mean, some of these young men and women are coming out into the world, and either they or their parents are in about $150,000 worth of loan debt at 8%. So many of these young people don't even really understand that they get their first payment. It's $1,539 on their first payment, and $1,239 of its interest. They don't even grasp this.
Yeah, I know. Well, that's part of the net. These kids get caught in the net, and they're not even party to the decisions. The decisions were made for them. It's tragic. But on top of that, as you just said, even though they're not involved in the decision, still they don't understand what kind of a fraud they're caught up in.
Why should someone start to understand who and what the Federal Reserve does? I mean, this is one of the last questions I want to ask. I got one or two more quick questions, but why should someone read your book, other than you wrote it and it's a great book, but what will this book assist them to understand?
Well, I'm thinking of who should read my book, and I think not everybody should read it, or not everybody will want to read it, let's put it that way. I think the only people who will want to read this book are those that have the crusader gene that I was talking about a moment ago. Not everybody gives a damn. They always figure, well, we get along. You know, whatever it is, you can't fight City Hall. You're not going to change anything. They're passive people. They go through school. They've been taught to be a team player. Don't make waves. Respect authority. Do what you're told, and you'll do just fine. And there are a lot of people that feel comfortable with that. And if that's the kind of person that is listening to this, I can tell you right now, you're not going to feel comfortable reading The Creature from Jekyll Island, because it's going to awaken some kind of a deep response that maybe you ought to do something about it. And the people that have that gene that says, hey, by golly, I've got to change the world. This is no good. It's not good for me. It's not good for my kids or my grandkids or way into the future of people I can't even imagine. This is not right. The people that have that kind of a response should read the book. Because if you're going to change the system, you have to know what's wrong with the system. You can't just have a lot of resolve. You can't just go out and say, Occupy Wall Street or something like that. I feel sorry for those people because they got the right idea. They don't like Wall Street for some of the reasons we're talking about. But what's their solution? Their solution is, oh, we got to have more government rules, more government laws, more government control.
Here's one of my last questions, Ed. Last questions. This book took courage to write because this you had to really dig deep here. What kind of adversity did you encounter in writing this book and then after the book?
This may surprise you, Jeff, but I've had very little. I've always expected it. I was prepared for it, and I still am. But I don't think that they want to call attention to my book. I think that's the only excuse I can think of. Either that or I'm not fighting hard enough. I haven't made a big enough dent in their armor because they pretty much left me alone so far. And, you know, it's one thing if I were a politician. You can knock out a politician with bad publicity or even with a bullet, and he's gone. But it's hard to knock out a writer because even though he's gone, his books remain. So that's one of the good things about being a writer is that when the day comes, for whatever reason, just because I get old and ornery or whatever it is, get hit by a bolide, those books are out there. And they will make a difference in the world.
Well, their book definitely makes a difference. Where can anyone purchase your book, The Creature from Jekyll Island, tonight?
Well, they're all over the Internet, but we'd like people to come to our website, which is realityzone.com. Realityzone.com, and we have about 100 different books and recordings there, but certainly The Creature from Jekyll Island is right at the top of the list.
You also are a cancer crusader. Make one last statement on that for me.
Oh, another one of my crusades, yes. Well, I got into that world. There's another red pill that I had to take that I had to break that illusion that the medical profession was really doing the best thing possible for my health. I discovered I have to take control of my own health, and I discovered that there is a control for cancer, and it's found in nature, but it will not be made available to the public because it cannot be patented and therefore is not of interest to the pharmaceutical industry. And that's the summary in a nutshell. If you want to read about that, my book is called World Without Cancer, The Story of Vitamin B17.
It's fascinating. I mean, Ed, you are one of the most unique, eclectic individuals I have ever had the privilege of sharing the stage with, spending quality time with. Looking forward to spending good time with you November 4th and 5th at the Protégé Writer Speakers Workshop. Mr. Ed Griffin, one more time, the website is?
Well, I've got a couple of them. I guess the one I want people to come to most of all is freedomforceinternational.org.
FreedomForceInternational.org, and the second one?
Well, that would be RedPillExpo.org. Redpill University. I got it wrong. RedPillUniversity.org. It's a project we're just putting online right now.
Ed, thank you for being on the call tonight. It's been a world-class interview. Love being your friend and collaborator. Look forward to spending quality time with you the 1st of November. Mr. Ed Griffin, everyone, this call is officially a call. Have a fantastic evening. Go to Ed's website. He has great books, content. Mind-blowing would be an understatement. Have a great evening, everyone.